that the chief fire warden asked me to collar her, so we collared her. Similarly, in Himachal, they had already caught the animal and they asked me if I'm an extra collar. And she was collared. And we didn't collar one leopardess because we went everything all ready to collar her. She had fallen in a well and they had got her out. But she had some serious injury on, like, between, like, her lip, her lower lip, no, was cut under the lip. Like, maybe, like, she had tried to get a dog which had a collar on it or something. I don't know. It was this really sharp cut. And she was a bit tiny. She was adult. Mm-hmm. But she was a bit tiny, so we thought, let's not hassle her anymore, so we didn't collar her. Yeah, and I also refused to collar any animal which had killed a human being or attacked a human being. So the two which collided with human beings, again, they had collided. It wasn't not a premeditated attack, no? Yeah, so that is why I collared, because I'd be very hesitant to collar an animal which has purposely attacked a human being.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And was the motivation to collar the animals mainly to understand, you know, sort of movement, how they use the landscape spatially, temporally?
Right. How they live among humans. I had also wanted to find out how close humans get to them, etc., etc. But that didn't work out because I had a bit of a bad luck in the students that I got for doing this work. So then, you know, whatever data we got, we just used that. Like, it could have been a much better study, but I guess it was the very first time I was getting students, so I wasn't experienced enough to figure out how to, in a human dominated landscape, it becomes really important the kind of people. I've told you this before, right?
Yeah,
so it's different in a forest. You can get any Tom, Dick and Harry to do whatever you want. But when you have to deal with people, no, it's like really, and I don't think wildlife people have that skill of or brain space that they need to be good with people. So that took a while. Yeah.
Right. So just since you mentioned the difference between human dominated landscapes and forests, I wanted to ask you, have you, I mean, this is a bit tangential, but have you ever felt like, you know, you want to just stop doing all of this and go and work on a cat in a forest and just study its biology and ecology?
No, so the thing that has happened after I started working in human-dominated landscapes is I cannot for the life of me watch a BBC documentary or anything that is that just shows wilderness.
Right, okay.
Because it's like just unidimensional. It is just so boring. Okay, whereas this, when you have people and you have different groups of people and all, it's like the difference that a foreign, like US or Europe is in terms of stimulus we Indians get versus India.
Right.
You know, India is just like hitting you all the time, all your senses and many more senses that you don't even know exist. Whereas over there, it's like just, you know, it's just one, you know, it's like that. So there's no way I really enjoy this complexity.
Okay, that's interesting. Yeah. No, because many people who have been studying, you know, problems outside protected areas, conservation issues, often feel that they would just like to go and instead watch animals in the wild, in places where there are no humans. That's clearly not the case with you.
Yeah, no, I think humans, see, I don't see humans as different from any other species. So I find I'm also observing humans and they fascinate me because if you forget the fact that, you know, they're people and all, but if you look at them as a species, they're incredibly fascinating. Right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
So what were the main sort of learnings from the collaring work?
One was that they are just everywhere, man. Like, you know, and you have no clue. Like, the day after collaring one fellow, he was sitting in the sugarcane field and the farmer was watering it at the edge, some 10 meters, 20 meters away. There were like some 20 women plucking tomatoes, some 20 meters away. Nobody had a clue. We went and asked the guy. We knew he was there, the leopard. So we asked the farmer, oh, have you seen leopards? See, they are here, but I saw one 3-4 days back. And this guy is sitting 10 meters away from him in the middle of the field. Yeah, and this was the norm. So that was fascinating that people didn't, you know, and they knew about them, but they weren't aware how close they are. Okay, and the way the leopards sit there, and like, you know, another time we were walking and there was sugarcane at the height of 12 feet on both sides of the road. And this is a mud road. And two women were sitting on their haunches doing some weeding. And one collared leopard was in one field or one side of the road. The mother was on the other side. You know, and nobody else was there for miles around. You know, so the how they keep away from people, you know, they don't attack people. You know, there was this, that was all the time that it was evident that despite being so close, despite being able to kill and take away if they wanted, they were just not doing it. That was one thing. The other thing was how close, like, they were living to people, you know, doing their stuff. And another thing, what was fascinating was it looked like, so we landed up collaring the mom and a sub-adult son, we realized later. They would walk together. And when she had her next litter, couple of nights, the sub-adults, she didn't come back to that resting space. And the sub-adult son was with the younger ones. You know, so just their life over there, like, you know, just, and then the her younger son fell in the well, and how she remained near the well till morning. Then she went back to her resting place. And then our Gule Kaka and all, I wasn't there that time. They rescued, they removed the little one, and then they left him near the well that same night. And in a, she then in about an hour, she had found him, because both she and her sub-adult son and the cubs, pug marks, all of them were together. You know how they are living their lives in this landscape, and how humans are leading their lives. And I mean, I don't know. Yeah, it was just. Yeah, a lot of crazy things.
Okay. And you know, when you communicated these findings from the collaring to the forest department, did it change the way they, you think, change the way they started thinking about this issue itself in terms of the presence of leopards in this landscape?
So I think the local forest department really knows, because they are all the time, you know, dealing with this, people are telling them, and many of them are locals itself. I think what, rather than these scientific information, if you ask me, I think what helped was the fact that there is this person who's studying these leopards outside of the narrative of fear and, you know, danger. I think that itself helped, because then the forest department, and then we had earlier also, since 2005, I was going there, and, you know, we tranquilize the leopards, microchip them. So the department would also be helping in this. So they got to see another kind of a leopard, which was peaceful, which was lovely, which was, you know, just sleeping. And then, you know, we were not scared of it. So, because till then, even for me in my head, the dominant narrative was, you know, fangs and fear and danger and killing. That was all. But when you go in anywhere, I think, I mean, even in Bombay, it helped. When you go in and give another narrative, you get the forest department to be part of it. They are involved in the tranquilization. They touch the animal. Everybody is fascinated by these animals at the end of the day. Right. And I think then that narrative changes from one of, I mean, I always say that fear and understanding are two sides of the same coin. You just flip it, and you know, then it changes the way people view these animals, or even human beings, like communities. Why are two communities against each other? Because they have no exposure or any understanding. The moment you have, like, you know, meals together or do business together, immediately the fear is gone, right? Acceptance comes in then. Right. Yeah. So same with unknown species like leopards, I think.
Right. And was this also the case with the people living in the area? You said the forest department started seeing this differently.
Even the people, like people, I think anyway, kind of, they see a different leopard there, because, you know, they would go and say, ha ha, he comes and drinks water from our water hole every night. And then once I went, They had kept a big pot of water on the road outside their house.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, what is that pot doing there? They said, oh, these hyenas and leopards otherwise come and drink from the trough of water we keep for our domestic animals. So they come all the way to our house. So we're keeping it up on the road, like, you know.
Okay.
So anyway, their relationship, but then when they read in media, you know, Adam Kaur and see on Discovery this man-eating graphics, you know, of the mountain lion going for the neck, it changes, I think, the way people see them. So it's definitely important. I think just the positive presence of a biologist or anybody working on these issues in their landscape makes 80% of the difference in the way. If you have a jerk working there, you will have a conflict.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you can create a conflict where none existed.
Right.
Yeah.
So it's very interesting what you're saying. So you're saying just your presence and the way you're studying the aspects of these animals that you're studying makes a difference. It doesn't matter so much what you find.
Right, I think so. Because, see, science, at the end of the day, I don't think our society is a very science-based society, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Highly superstitious, highly religious, especially rural India.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I mean, I will not even say that. In my own family, you know, is highly superstitious. So, so it doesn't matter. I think what matters more is what kind of a human being you are when you work there. You can tell them that the leopard farts through his nose and they'll be okay with it. No, I'm not kidding. I'm very serious when I say this.
Right.
Yeah. Which I think makes sense when Ghule Kaka called me and said, you know, if you want people to listen to this person next year saying that live with the leopard, they are not going to want to listen to this person because the person doesn't know how to behave.
Right. But at the same time, you know, is it also that science brings with it an authority that something comes across as being said by scientists or being found by scientists has...
Right. Yeah, that it does. But I think more important than that is how the scientist goes and interacts there. You can go with all the authority in the world, but if you are a jerk, you're going to have a conflict.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Right. So, Vidya, I want to change tracks a little bit and ask you about, you know, sort of your career path. And you finished your PhD in 2012. Is that correct?
Right.
Yeah. And so, immediately, what did you do immediately after you finished your PhD?
So, 2011, Dr. Karanth, Ulas Karanth, who was my PhD guide. In 2011, he asked me to join CWS as a staff. And I was a bit... hesitant because, you know, he's known to be a difficult person to work with. But he was totally fine with me working from home and stuff like that. So I wouldn't have got that opportunity anyway. So I said, yes. So since 2011, I've been working with him in his organization. And then he made me part of WCS. So now I'm with WCS.
Okay. And what was your role? Were you continuing your work on leopards?
Did you
take on additional sort of responsibilities in this?
No. So, Ullas just said you do whatever you're doing. That's fine. So, I did take on more students and more projects and stuff later. Yeah. So, but it was whatever I wanted to do. He had full faith in me and that I really appreciate him. For that, like, because I think I'm the kind of person who can only work if I'm given full freedom. If I'm micromanaged, I'm going to be a horrible person to work with. So that way, he was really, hello, you're there?
Yeah, I can hear you, yes.
Yeah. So that way, it really worked out well.
Okay. And, you know, this might just be my reading of the situation, but I get the sense that an organization like WCS has a very different... worldview on conservation, maybe from the view that you have. I was wondering if those were things that came up during your time there, in the sense that WCS seems to be an organization that emphasizes protected areas, setting aside spaces for conservation.
Right.
Or is this just my perception?
No. You're absolutely right. See, the thing is, WCS origin is in US. Okay, where protected areas are the dominant model for conservation, right? And even today in the US, like, although they are having urban carnivores and urban predators, they don't have wildlife like the way India has. And believe me, I think even before I started working, the dominant narrative in India from not just WCS, but everywhere was protected areas. Right? Except for a few people working outside protected areas, like less than a handful. Everybody was talking about protected areas. I mean, in the conservation field, of course, tribal rights are a different group, so I'm not going there.
Right.
But the conservation thing, everybody thought. So I think these are philosophies, essentially. And India, I think, is a very unique case because even today, it has so much wildlife, majority of it outside. Right. And now we are seeing it and we are accepting it. And it's a very different way of there is this. I don't know why, but I think it's the West. I don't know if I can call it the West, but it's definitely not Indian to have dichotomies in the way we see the world. But you have this land sharing. What do you call it?
Land sharing, land sparing.
Yeah, the philosophy of land sharing and it doesn't have to be one or the other. And in India, it is not one or the other. It's all kinds. Just as we have all kinds of genders, all kinds of people, all kinds of languages, all kinds of food, it's part of what we are. Okay. So I think increasingly we are appreciating it and understanding it. I mean, I had to not just. So the thing with Ullas is at the end of the day, he's one of the brightest people I've met, and he understands cats really well. So I have to say, so mine is leopard. So a lot of people, including journalists, some really renowned national winning journalists, award winning journalists, and Ullas and a lot of all these people are like, yeah, leopards. Leopards can live anywhere. But I was like, lions are living and they are social animals. They are living among people. But they are like, okay, lions. And tigers, no way tigers can live among people. But now studies are showing that tigers are living in human-dominated landscapes. Right? So it was really interesting because when Ullas, when we collared Kala, who was a tigress, she lived only outside the protected area. Okay, and I called Ullas after 2 weeks because I had a really good student who was monitoring her 24/7. And the student was just not finding any kills made by Kala, the tigress. So I asked Ullas, like, how much would you expect them to eat in that 2 weeks, you know? So I remember Ullas telling me, Vidya, you have to be prepared. I know it'll be like emotionally, you know, bad, but these animals will not last outside the protected areas and stuff, okay? This bloody Kala went on to live for like 2 years, and I think some 3-4 years later, she sat in front of the WCT camera traps with her cubs, you know. And Ullas, I think after a year, he asked me, you really think they can reproduce outside protected area? And I said, yes, I think they can, you know. So I think everything is a learning journey, but some of the philosophies are so deeply rooted, I think, especially in people from outside our culture. You know, like if you take WCS New York, or it's not just W, like recently I had this talk with Tarsh and Sahil and stuff. And there was a person, I think, from Survival International who attended it, didn't get the nuance that we are talking about wildlife living in human-used landscape. We are not talking about wildlife and tribals living in a protected area because they don't have these kind of complexities in their conservation landscape. Yeah, so, I mean, I think it's always evolving philosophies. And I mean, if you can evolve with the thoughts and the times, that's great. And I think Ullas did it, at least. You know, I think he did it to a much greater extent than I would have expected him to do. Yeah.
So what was this tiger eating outside?
So she was, see, we didn't get many prey, but we did get some wild boar. See, there's, and we got some nilgai. Yeah, there's a lot of wild prey also, which uses the these areas, and they are like the tigers. They sit in the day and they roam around in the night. So there is enough wild prey, but then there's also a hell of a lot of livestock in that landscape. So there are a couple of livestock kills she's been photographed at. Yeah, so India has the highest density of livestock in the world. We have more livestock in our landscape than we have humans. Not talking about dogs and all, just livestock. And having said that, there's a lot of mortality. Like in Akole, for instance, where they've shifted to hybrid cattle, the they have quite a lot of mortality at birth, is what Ghule Kaka told me. Okay, so then they discard these dead newborns. And you have the hyenas and leopards coming to these places. And there are usually certain places they go and discard, you know. It's not all over the place. And you have leopards and hyenas coming. So all these things are important, I guess. Like, for instance, in Gujarat, they have a lot, like, lot of cattle that are just free roaming, feral, old cattle that are just, they don't kill there, right? Which are just, and lions, for lions, it's great, no?
Yeah, it's interesting. So that you mentioned the mortality of cattle. I don't remember where I read it, but somewhere you say that, you know, one way to think about this is that that these people suffer mortality to their livestock from so many other causes, disease. You know, instead of focusing so much on the livestock loss to wild animals, maybe one conservation intervention might be to try and solve other problems. Can you say a little more about that?
Yeah, because what, you know, like being a nicely trained wildlife biologist, the moment I went to Akole, I was like, shit, these farmers, their goats are being killed by leopards. Every goat that is attacked, I will work with a veterinarian from Pune and I'll get them to come and treat these goats. Unfortunately, John Linnell was there with me that time. He's like, Vidya, I don't think you should do this because you should wait and see what your results say before you take on an intervention. You don't know what impact that intervention will have if it's not rooted in knowledge. And I was like, no, no, no. But then, you know, it didn't work out, fortunately, okay? Because as part of my questionnaires, and then even later on, there is a book by Andrew Loveridge where he compiles all the mortalities by predators. I think mostly it's 5% of the mortality of the livestock is due to predators. Diseases, because these are domesticated and they live in such large congregations near each other, diseases are a much bigger factor of mortality, and the farmers see it. We as biologists have so far only been asking them mortality due to predators, put it in dollars and publish it. You know, so definitely, I think, you know, if you if disease is thing, then, you know, vaccination or even, like, I believe what a good way forward is to have a community owned, you know, maybe to the poorest members of the community, even if you give them a seed goat couple, like, you know, two females and one male to the really poor people, that's hardly any money. The states are spending crores per year for livestock compensation, which is only going to increase. And then the moment a goat is killed, this pool is, the one female goat has, I think, 2 liters per year or something. You know, you just replace, and it's community run. You don't have the forest department needing to be involved in it. Yeah, so they're doing this with fishing cats and goats in Hooghly somewhere. There's one pilot where a local NGO has been doing, and apparently it really works well. I don't know if they've assessed it, but yeah. So I think something that is more, I personally believe that we have to plan an exit strategy for our work. If you're talking about doing veterinary services, that means that NGO is going to be involved. That means you need funds from an external thing, blah, blah, blah. But I think if every project plans an exit strategy, then automatically you start thinking, how can you enable the community itself to deal with this? And I think that is, to me, the perfect conservation model, where you can enable the community to handle it by themselves and you leave. Yeah.
So in your own work, do you think that the situation in Maharashtra in these landscapes has reached a point where it no longer requires your presence?
So Akole, for instance, I stopped working there because I was like, what the hell do I do here? Like, you know, there's no human attacks.
Mm-hmm.
The forest department knows how to handle it well.
Mm-hmm.
There are no human deaths. There are occasional injuries. The people are seemingly okay with the leopards. And the forest department has really improved its compensation system. Like when I started working there 2007-8, they were taking like many months, up to 2 years to get compensation, which would not come properly. Now it is directly into their account, you know, and they can go to the forest office and track their application online. I think there's still scope for improvement. Like if in the railway system, you get them a SMS saying your case has been reached and this is where the decision is and this is the amount we are processing. I think that is even better transparency, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was nothing really in Akole for me to do. And the thing is, no hurry, these are very complex social issues also, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I, as an outsider, going and starting something there, I have no idea what I'm going to affect and mm-hmm. how I'm going to affect the situation, which is otherwise fine as of now.
Mm-hmm.
So right. I stepped out of Akole because I thought there's nothing. I mean, just for the sake of running a project, I don't want. Then Bombay happened. Again, Bombay, I'm no longer part of it since 2013, but it's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that, I think, is awesome. That, and it'll go on for a while unless there's some serious problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that is the way. Like most landscapes you're working, you need only a little bit of intervention.
Mm-hmm.
Junnar would have been a good place, but it's also a very political place where I don't want to go and work.
Mm-hmm.
So that again is a, you know, I should also get a joy of working there, right?
Yeah. Okay. So, it's almost an hour. I just wanted to, could you sort of quickly tell us what is the work you've been doing since 2012? I mean, I have a sense of it from the publications.
Right.
But I'm wondering if there's something that is not captured by the publication that you've been doing since 2012.
No, so since 2012 was also the time when my daughter became a teenager, and then my a bit later, 2016 or so, my ailing mom came to live with us. So I wanted more time for myself. So I was working only part-time, in the sense I was working 3 weeks out of 4 a month.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, what I'll do is I will mentor students.
Mm-hmm.
So I mentored, we had a really lovely team of a lot of youngsters.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what I largely did. I didn't take up any projects because I wanted to have some time at home. I'd worked like crazy from 2003.
Right.
Yeah. So, and everything is published and everything is online and everything is there for people to see. So,
okay.
I mean, I was just mentoring.
So, right. So from that, what I see is that it's been more of leopard work but expanding to other landscapes as well.
Right. Because if there are good students who, I don't see much difference in the issues, be it leopard or wolf or elephant living among humans. The issues are the same.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think the species here is that much a thing as wildlife and human use landscapes.
Right. So can you say a little bit about the wolf work? Because I don't think I came across sort of material on it.
Oh, I'll send you the report to remind me.
Okay, sure.
Yeah. So the wolf work, Iravati Majgaonkar, she's from NCBS master's student. She was really interested in the semi-arid landscapes.
Uh-huh.
So we tried to do this short collaborative project. Like when Mr. Limaye came to Pune, we had just finished our Bombay project and I was living in Pune, he was in Pune. So he said, let's do something similar on wolves.
Mm-hmm.
So we started the project and we again were very inclusive, took on anybody who wanted to come on and just whatever. Like there were a lot of social science components to that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not as much ecology because it's a bit, we didn't have any funds for that project, little bit of funds.
Mm-hmm.
But Iravati went on to get some funds and she moved. Pune was a hard place to work because it's a very fractured landscape for wolves. There's like this wolf people who are more territorial than the wolves. And It was really very draining. So we decided not to do much work there. So Iravati went to Karnataka then later. She got a lot of funds and she did some really nice stuff looking at the losses people have. Like similar stuff she did in Maharashtra as well, interviewing the Dhangars and all to see what kind of, what is more important to them, losses due to wolves or, you know, other issues, you know, in the landscape and what. And we tried to engage with one of the communities near Supe Wildlife Sanctuary, to try and see if we could improve grass availability to them and all. But that, when Mr. LeMay left, I mean, it all just collapsed. So, yeah, so it didn't stick around. But Ira did a lot of, like, she worked for 2 years, I think, in Karnataka. And that she will publish. She just got into a PhD program, so she's busy with that. But you can see that paper from what the Pune Wolf work, what a really nice thing she did was, that Mr. LeMay helped get the entire seven or eight districts on the top of the Ghats, no, the semi-arid landscape, right from Nashik on the top till Satara at the bottom, Kolhapur. We interviewed, she interviewed the forest guards and the daily labor there and got huge occupancy through interviews to find out where wolves, hyenas and leopards occur in that landscape.
Okay.
Yeah, and have you seen that paper?
I think I have, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was because we knew that they are there and we just wanted to show the extent to which they do occur outside protected areas. And, you know, it's really important for policy because I think nobody really realizes the scale to which these wild animals are using human use landscape. So I thought that was a lovely paper out of that.
Right. Yeah, Iravati is the first author on that paper.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I think I've seen it briefly. I'll look it up. If there are any sort of follow up questions on that, I'll ask it in the next session. But for now, we can stop this session and we can continue.
Okay.
I'll just stop the recording.
Sure.